Good morning. 135 people have it, none of them wanted it, and it could have been avoided if someone hadn't contaminated their food. Greg Fraser of the Hawaii Restaurant Association has some choice words from his industry. And around the country, cities are celebrating a huge drop in veteran homelessness, but with inherent affordable housing issues in Hawaii, how will our state get to functional zero? Today, State Homelessness Coordinator Scott Morishige looks at some new strategies. I'm Beth Ann Koslovich.
I'm Chris Vandercook. Choreographer Septime Webb works all over the world and is in Hawaii to put together a nutcracker unlike any other. And what will it take to move humanity away from the threat of nuclear war? A Maui memorial to the Hiroshima bombing asks us to reflect on preventing nuclear war from a non-killing perspective.
That's the conversation. Now news.
Good morning and welcome to The Conversation. I'm Chris Vandercook. Good morning, Beth Ann.
Good morning.
Looking into homeless veterans in Hawaii, yeah?
Yeah, absolutely. You may remember that, you know, last year there was a lot of excitement among nonprofits working with homeless veterans. The agencies were hopeful that they could house every veteran who wanted a home. And Chris, you may remember that there was the Landlord Summit in Honolulu last November. That spawned others across the state, and as you also may remember, Honolulu had been participating in the national initiative, the Mayor's Challenge to End Veteran Homelessness. Yet, by the end of the year, there were still 51 veterans not housed. That made this week's announcement by President Obama of a 17% decrease in veteran homelessness more poignant for Hawaii, where the drop was recorded as only 3%. And while Honolulu says the numbers weren't reflected in, or rather its numbers weren't reflected in the figures that President Obama used, the question still remains, how can Hawaii get to functional zero in veteran homelessness? State Coordinator on Homelessness Scott Morishige joins us now with what he sees as a way forward. Good morning.
Oh, good morning, Beth Ann.
Good to talk to you again. Nice to have you here. This was kind of a tough one this week when we saw those numbers come out, and yet clearly Honolulu, Oahu, throughout the state, been working very hard to decrease, in particular, veteran homelessness.
Well, I think it's important to point out that while the statewide decrease in veterans homelessness was only 3%, on Oahu it was actually a 12% decrease, and I think that's significant. We really have come a long way in really building a system that has the capacity to quickly identify someone who's unsheltered on the street, assess their needs, and link them to the appropriate level of care so that they're not only housed, but also get the right amount of supportive services to be able to maintain their housing over time. I think our goal of working towards, you know, what we call functional zero, it doesn't mean that we want to end homelessness for everybody, but it's really about building the system, increasing the capacity of our community so that we are able to respond quickly. And I think we're getting there. But one of the challenges is that we have a critical housing shortage here in Hawaii, and particularly a lack of affordable housing inventory. So as we look at how to build out the system, we really need to be strategic in how we place our resources to kind of address some of those barriers that are coming up.
Which is the conversation we always come back to. We need the inventory. How can you house people who want to be housed if there's no housing for them? We've heard a lot about, you know, transit-oriented development, things that may come down the pike. But as the end of last year happened and we're looking at 51 veterans who couldn't be housed even though they wanted to be housed, that seemed to be just an overwhelmingly sad situation that there couldn't be, you know, a place to be able to find for 51 veterans, and especially as we had been doing so well in progressing toward functional zero for veterans homelessness.
So I think a couple things that we're doing to be able to address those challenges. One is really looking at how we can partner with state, city, and county, and others to be able to really share our resources and leverage different funding streams to be able to kind of fill some of these gaps. A good example is the city and county of Honolulu recently has been acquiring a number of properties that they want to use to address homelessness, but they don't necessarily have the service dollars available to provide permanent supportive housing. And what permanent supportive housing is, it's housing that's not only the physical structure, but it has that wraparound support that people need. And for some of these veterans, some of that 51 that you're referencing, their level of need is really high. So they need really intensive wraparound services and care that unfortunately does cost funding, and you need to dedicate resources to that. So we're talking to city and county about how can the state possibly provide some of the wraparound services, the city provide the physical structure, and that'll address some of the people who are falling through the cracks.
Which brings up the point that we're not just talking about people who are discharged and, oops, they can't find a home, and they're veterans and that they need to have some help, but there are some really chronic issues with some of them. Not all of them, but with some of them. So at this point, when that isn't networked well enough for those veterans, do you think that somehow we need to kind of reshape or recalibrate how we look at veterans and what happens with the system as they are being discharged here?
Well, I think what's important is that we really need to take a comprehensive approach, and that really is the approach that the state is taking to kind of direct resources for homelessness. So a couple weeks ago, Governor Ige announced the state's framework to address homelessness, and it's really focused on three leverage points that we believe it's really critical that we address simultaneously in order to keep our momentum moving forward. The first really is affordable housing. We need to build more inventory clearly that's affordable at all income levels. We also need to maximize the inventory we have. So doing events like the Landlord Summit to build that engagement and better be able to utilize the spaces we currently have. The second is health and human services, really focusing on effective interventions like Housing First and rapid rehousing that we know are evidence-based and work in other parts of the country. And third is really looking at public safety. As we have a growing number of encampments on public lands, and we know that government has an obligation to respond, we want to make sure that we link those public safety and enforcement efforts together with housing and human services so that we're not just moving people from place to place, but we're really using those opportunities as a place to engage homeless individuals, including veterans, and link them to this right level of care. In addition to that framework I talked about, another important part is to focus on data. We really need to strengthen our existing data system. So as part of the state's approach moving forward, we are dedicating an amount of money to increase our data infrastructure, to really invest in the homeless management information system so that we can better pinpoint the needs of homeless veterans and other individuals, and that'll allow us to kind of better inform how we allocate these resources.
I mean, that sounds to be reasonably logical. A lot of people listening thinking, well, of course you need to be able to maintain a database and know who needs what and be able to coordinate those services. But especially for veterans, just to take this part of the equation out for a moment, there are a lot of people who feel that we have a special obligation to veterans, and that there should be something more that's being offered to them, even if they are chronic, but that they should have, if not first dibs, but certainly a lot more attention being paid to them than some say that we are. You just came back from a summit in Washington, D.C. over this last week. Was there any further discussion about veterans and anything that would be made especially available for homeless veterans?
So we have a number of resources in our community to specifically address the needs of homeless veterans. There's a significant amount of federal funding for VASH, which is a Section 8 rental subsidy specific for veterans with a preference for veterans who are chronically homeless. We also have a resource called SSVF, or Supportive Services for Veterans and Their Families, which is a shorter term rental subsidy which can provide either one time or a few months of assistance to help a family stabilize. One of the things the city and county of Honolulu have been working on is really bringing service providers together, establishing a by-name list of homeless veterans, really kind of targeting, using that to kind of target our allocation resources. And it has been working. That's how we've been able to make progress. We've achieved that 12% reduction in the number of homeless veterans on Oahu. And I think although it's maybe not as much progress as some would hope for, we are still making progress, and it's still a bright spot. And I think we need to kind of build on that, continue the coordination, continue these efforts that we're making, because we are headed in the right direction. And homelessness is not something that we're going to solve overnight. This is something that's going to take time.
I mean, most people understand a lot of that, and they've been hearing some of these arguments in part or some for a very long time. In terms, though, of taking this apart just mm-hmm. for veterans, since that's what the president was pointing to this week, and seeing 17% across the nation, even at 12% for Oahu, that's still not, you know, it's 5% short of what everyone else has experienced aggregate-wise. And progress is progress. I mean, mm-hmm. I think everybody understands that progress is progress, and different places mm-hmm. are making progress, and it wasn't 70% in every place. It was simply, you know, that's what the average was. So right now, if you had your druthers and you could be able to find places, because that's what really it mm-hmm. seems to boil down to. It seems to boil down to how do you find appropriate places for these veterans who are still left without some place to live, even if they need a lot of chronic services. People being open to renting to them is a big part of that.
It is, and I think it's been part of the continued effort of both the state and the counties to engage the landlord community. We've convened landlord summits not only here in Honolulu, but in every part of the state. We did one in Maui in June, and we've had landlord summits earlier the year in Hilo and in West Hawaii. I think we're, again, we are making progress. I think specifically with this veterans population, Hawaii is also part of the 25 cities technical assistance effort. So we're one of 25 communities with the highest rates of homelessness in the nation. And the 25 cities effort is specifically focused on the needs of homeless veterans, and we're receiving a lot of technical support to help us continue moving forward in the right direction. I think beyond just looking at the homeless veteran population, we know that we have one of the highest rates of homelessness per capita in the nation, and we really need to build a system that focuses not just on the needs of a specific subpopulation, but really a system that's capable of helping anyone, whether they're a homeless veteran, homeless family, a youth who's falling in homelessness, into a place where they're connected with the right type of resources to be able to get into a home and then also stay there over time so they don't fall back.
For the moment, we're going to leave it there. We'll check in with you as we continue to move through this year, see where we are.
Okay, thank you, Bethan.
Thanks, Scott, for coming in. Scott Morishige is the State Coordinator on Homelessness. You're listening to The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. It's now 8:16. Coming up, a ballet master comes to the islands to mark a Ballet Hawaii anniversary. First, though, your backyard quiz.
In today's backyard, we're pulling up the moashi and stepping into the sumo ring. Chad Ha'aheo Rowan, better known as Akebono, had an illustrious 13-year sumo career. He won the Emperor's Cup 11 times and retired with a record of 566-198 in the top division. Hailing from Hawaii, Akebono was the first foreign-born wrestler ever to reach Yokozuna, the highest rank in sumo. Holding the title of Yokozuna, his top rivals became his own brothers, Takanohana and Wakanohana. The rivalry became so entertaining that it led to televised sumo in the States between the late 1980s and early 1990s. A beloved island athlete and successful one to boot, a statue was commissioned in his honor here in Hawaii. Can you tell us the location of Akebono's statue? We'll have the answer in the second half of the show. Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. And the first one to get it right gets the T-shirt.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Hawaii Pacific University, joining the Hawaii Farm Bureau for the new Aloha Tower Farmers Market every Friday from 4 to 7 p.m. at the Aloha Tower Marketplace. Grand opening tomorrow.
Septim Weber has made dances for ballet companies all over the world, and he's in Hawaii to tailor a classic ballet to a Hawaii setting and to Hawaii history. It's the kind of project that makes more sense the more you think about it. After all, the Nutcracker is set in an elegant mansion at a party where all the important people are in attendance. Transfer that to Washington Place in 1858 with Liliu Okalani, David Kalakaua, and Bernice Pauahi Bishop in attendance, and you begin to see the possibilities. Septim is the choreographer and artistic director of the new Ballet Hawaii 40th anniversary production, and he's with us in our studio. Good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for coming in.
Great to be here.
As you think about the possibilities of this setting, you know, changing the setting to what would later become Washington Place, there are any number of ways in which the story can be adapted, aren't there?
Sure. Well, the central fact about The Nutcracker is it's got this amazing score by Tchaikovsky.
Yeah.
And this beautiful story about a young girl coming of age. Mm-hmm. And it sends audiences a message about the importance to retain a childlike wonderment about the world, a kind of joyful approach to the world as one becomes an adult. This is archetypical. And so it transcends specificity of place or time.
And those are the things to hang on to no matter what you do with the production, right?
Absolutely. And it makes, therefore, the production somewhat flexible. Mm-hmm. And it happens that Mary Dominus, the first owner of Washington Place, gave a Christmas Eve party in 1858. And she had the first Christmas tree in Hawaii. And she opened the doors of this beautiful mansion to 100 Hawaiian children at this first Christmas party. And the parallels to Nutcracker's Christmas Eve party are so distinct.
Yeah.
It seemed like really great. And she's she was the future mother-in-law of Lydia, the future queen of Hawaii. Mm-hmm. So she was at the center of social Honolulu. And so it just seemed so parallel,
sure.
So perfect.
So between what you know and what you can extrapolate from what you know, there's an awful lot to work with, isn't there?
Absolutely. You know, ballet's not really a great language to teach history.
Yeah.
Our language is metaphorical. So as such, the basic framework is based in fact, is in history, with these characters, as you say, there. Mm-hmm. And the party scene set is actually based on the interior of Washington Place. When audiences come in, they'll see a beautiful front drop of the exterior of Washington Place, circa 1858. In fact, we also have then created composite characters. You know, the important trading partners of Hawaii included China and Great Britain at the time. So ambassadors from those countries will be party guests. Composites of characters that were there. So the party scene is based in the real here and now.
Mm-hmm.
But in fact, the rest of the ballet is Clara's dream.
Yeah.
And it's a fantasy, and she dreams through time. And the snow scene is set on Mauna Kea, where, in fact, there's snow.
Perfect.
And Act Two, the traditional sort of Kingdom of the Sweets, is a beautiful tropical garden, giant, oversized, beautiful pink trumpet flowers. And all of the divertissement of Act Two have been adapted to reflect some aspects of Hawaiian nature, the natural world largely. You know, the Spanish dance is now a dance for orchids. The traditional marzipan or merlitons or shepherdesses is a dance for Eevee birds. The Mother Ginger is Mother Moana, Mother Ocean, and her clownfish, the little clowns sort of based on clownfish. The Waltz of the Flowers is waltzing plumeria. So the whole production is a Nutcracker production, but in fact tweaked to reflect aspects of the world we actually live in.
Well, one of the things I get from what you're telling me, Septim, is just how much preparation goes into, you know, several performances of a ballet set for next year, February, right?
Sure. We're in December. We're in December.
Sorry.
We're opening Christmas.
Of course,
Christmas of 2016, mm-hmm. just a few months at the Blaisdell. It's taken an army. I mean, we've got a huge team of collaborators. The Ballet Hawaii folks have been amazing. Also, the party scene is being designed, the costume designs by Kini Zamora, mm-hmm. noted fashion designer who just came in second place on Project Runway, a real superstar from Honolulu. Just really extravagant, particularly his gowns for Mary Dominus and for the future queen, Lulu Kulani, are amazing, just drop-dead gorgeous. So it's been fun, and I've sought to encode all of the moments with some decisions that are informed by the DNA of the Hawaii I've come to really love and know. The audience won't necessarily see all of them or get all of them. They're just design decisions or staging decisions that retain the DNA of the place. But we're focusing on the story of a beautiful young girl, Clara, coming of age. For example, the toy soldiers, the designs are, the little toy soldiers are actually Iolani Palace guards mm-hmm. who fight the menacing Mouse King. The menacing rats are South Sea pirates. So there's we've taken it seriously when we have characters like the David Kalakaua and Bernice, et cetera, but then had a lot of fun with the whimsical fantasy moments as well.
One of the things we talked about this a little bit before the show, and you're sticking with the dance language of classical ballet.
Yeah, that's important. It's a classical ballet, and will include dancers and students from Ballet Hawaii, but also a whole slew of about 8 or 10 real superstars from the mainland. So it'll be really chock full of virtuosic, exuberant classical and neoclassical ballet. Hawaii has its own really strong and rich dance tradition, and the story of Hawaii has been told so beautifully through this Hawaii tradition. I wanted to be respectful of that, and so we don't really make allusions to that dance language. I wanted to ensure that there was a respectful, elegant, essentially a kind of grown-up approach to the classical ballet, and not present a kind of pastiche that would be either tacky or disrespectful, but instead be truly respectful to this great tradition of ballet and our sister or brother language, which is hula.
Sure.
Just a different kind of way. You know, what we're doing as dancers is we're expressing the world around us, and that can be just expressed in different kinds of ways.
Well, with any dance language, you can't half do it, right?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, being a ballet dancer is a kid starts when they're six, and it's like the 10,000-hour rule.
Exactly.
Plus, 10,000-hour plus.
Yeah. Well, you've put in your time.
Let me tell you, I've got the aches and pains to show for it.
Hey, for it's sure. Great to talk to you again. Thanks for coming.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here. Thanks so much.
Septim Weber is the choreographer and artistic director of Ballet Hawaii's annual holiday season Nutcracker. Performances will run from December 15th to 17th, and the island-inspired Nutcracker coincides with the 40th anniversary of Ballet Hawaii.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Blue Note Hawaii Jazz Club, presenting vocalist Jody Watley and her group Shalimar Reloaded in two shows nightly, on stage August 18th through 21st. Tickets at BlueNoteHawaii.com.
Oahu residents aren't happy about it, but it seems they may simply feel it's too late to turn back now. A Civil Beat poll shows over half of those surveyed want rail built all the way to Ala Moana, even if that means hiking the GET. Civil Beat reporter Chad Blair has a reality check. Good morning.
Good morning, Bethann.
It's surprising that they would feel this way, or at this point, given what we've seen so far, really just, well, that's just the way life is. It's going to have to go forward.
Well, the way our pollster, Merriman River, described it, Matt Fitch is in charge of the company. He said, it's not buyer's remorse exactly, but at this point, let's just finish the damn thing. That was his wording. Now, just because 64%, and that's a pretty healthy majority, want the full rail line built, the full 20 miles to Alamoana, does not in any way indicate that it is popular, because this very same poll that we have up today shows that 41% of people say that how the whole thing is unfolded, specifically the cost overruns and the tax increase extensions, particularly the general excise tax, is troubling. That's the word that is used in the poll. Another 42% say the whole idea is bad to begin with, rail. Only 15% feel good about it. But the takeaway seems to be, gee, since it's come this far, and as you know, we just authorized the extension from the airport to Middle Street, right, until the money runs out, the sense is let's just keep going, and if necessary, let's go back to the general excise tax as a way to pay for it.
Which seems to be very good news for Mayor Caldwell and for Peter Carlisle, since they have been strongly advocating that this thing go all the way. Maybe not such good news for Charles DeJoux.
Right, although I should caution, the state legislature would have to approve this. And as you know, the money chairs there were not happy the way things went last time. And for Kirk Caldwell, let's say he wins re-election, for him to go back to the legislature and say, well, we're going to ask for even more money. Both Carlisle and Caldwell have indicated there may be other ways to get money, federal money, other federal monies, although there's some doubt about that. The mayor has even talked about some private partnerships as well. It's DeJoux, of course, who has said, I'm not going to spend any more of our taxpayer money on this. And by that, he means Oahu taxpayers. That does leave open the option, the possibility that maybe there would be federal funding.
Federal,
of course,
dollars,
he's Yeah, and he's proposed some other things, like maybe changing, going to at grade, meaning having the rail at ground level, or maybe having a bus rapid transit thing. But there does seem to be an indication that we'd be willing to pay for it. I should say only 8%, a very small minority, think that we should use property taxes. Property taxes are not part of the mix to pay for rail. There was a combination, about 25% said, you know, maybe you could balance it between rail and GET. But just to stress, property taxes are not currently tapped to pay for the rail line.
And, of course, about a third of the GET is borne by those who are visitors.
Right. Statewide, that's the figure. I'm told that here on Oahu, it's about 20%. But that's something that the mayor has pointed out as, look, it's a lot of this is coming from the people that come and stay in our hotels and use our resources. So anyway, interesting poll up on our site about rail, and could be fodder for the election campaign, which, as you know, is coming to a conclusion very soon.
Right. I don't think the word could is in there. It is. We all know that everybody wants to talk about rail, but you know, this, you want to talk about a reality check. If this is it, yeah, that people want it built all the way, then there are going to be other actions and consequences that will follow. Thanks a
Agreed.
Bunch. I'll talk to you in the morning.
Thanks, Bethan.
Chad Blair reports for Civil Beat and joins us every day with a reality check. Millennial minds know, and the rest of us would like to. This week on Town Square, we'll look at Hawaii through millennial eyes and why some say now that they're in their middle 30s, their priorities are shifting. Is there really a millennial mindset, or is that more old comedy than reality? We'll find out later today at 5 on Town Square.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Bronster Fujichaku Robbins, a civil litigation law firm handling major cases on all islands for clients of all sizes, from individuals to Fortune 500 corporations. BFRHawaii.com.
Health department eyes are on Oahu to figure out the source of hepatitis A. 135 people have been sickened by the disease. None of them had to be. But by now you know that the highly contagious illness is transmitted through ingested food or water contaminated by fecal matter, which boils down to a lot of people not washing their hands. And there's clear evidence that they don't. Recent studies show anywhere from one half to a third to two-thirds of people don't wash their hands or don't wash them long enough. That may make a lot of folks think twice about going to a restaurant. Not good news for Greg Fraser, the executive director of the Hawaii Restaurant Association. He's in our studio now with some words from his industry. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you so much for having me
today.
Good
to have you here. Yeah. Now, a couple of things that we know about this, that just because the disease has turned up in people who worked at certain places, Baskin-Robbins, Chili's, the Costco Bakery in Hawaii, even at Hawaiian Airlines, it doesn't mean that they were the ones who originated the infection, that they might very well have gotten it someplace else and didn't realize it and passed it on because it's contagious.
Sure, that's exactly right. And, you know, we got to realize that it is still safe to go to these places. Obviously, it's still safe to fly on Hawaiian Airlines or go to Costco or Baskin-Robbins. These are isolated incidents, and they have been, you know, taken care of. They've been addressed.
But we're watching, you know, things, sales at Baskin-Robbins plummet, people looking at you know, restaurants maybe with a fish eye. Even they see the nice green sign up there, the pass that says, yes, you can go in. The mere fact that you can have places that have those green passes that clearly turned up with Hep A is proof that, you know, something has happened. Well, obviously, we're dealing with a human condition, and given a lot of the research that we've seen, even just over the past 2 years in Canada, in the United States, in Great Britain, that people seem to just forget to wash their hands after they come out of the bathroom.
Well, one of the reasons why the Department of Health and Sanitation have the green placard ruling or process there is when the inspectors go in and they deem a place compliant with the rules and regulations, you'll get that green placard, or if you're not compliant, you'll get a yellow, and God forbid if you get the red, that shuts down your restaurant. Typically, that's for more temperature-related issues than, you know, foodborne illness or whatnot. So if you do see the green placard, that means that that restaurant is compliant. Now, you mentioned it. You need to make sure, the management and the owner need to make sure that your staff is following those rules and regulations. And not only are you washing your hands when you leave the restroom, but there are also hand sinks as you enter back into the kitchen. And that's a requirement from the Department of Health and Sanitation, is that you wash your hands at both places, because you don't know what you're touching on the way from the restroom back into the kitchen.
All of this, I'm sure, has been a great headache for a lot of people who have restaurants or other hospitality concerns. And they're trying to make sure that people understand that they are doing their best to follow the rules. But given the fact that there is a vaccine for this, is this something that you think that your industry would be in favor of having anyone who is working in food service at all having to have a vaccination? I mean, we make kids have TB vaccinations before they go to school.
Sure.
Why would this be potentially any different?
Well, now that it's been coming to light more and more, and some of the media is calling it an outbreak, we've looked at it for the past few weeks. The Hawaii Restaurant Association has done some research into exactly, you know, where can you get these vaccination shots. Obviously, the pharmacies, and we've contacted a couple dozen of the pharmacies here locally, and you know, we're finding that there are varied levels of cost for the vaccination shot. We're finding that you need a prescription from your doctor. We're finding that some of the health insurance providers cover it. But we're not exactly sure, or the pharmacy's not exactly sure what your copay will be and what the cost will be. So we found that it's not very easy for somebody just to go down and, you know, like how easy it is to get a flu shot today. You know, you go down and they're free, and it takes you 5 minutes and you're in and out. So one of the things that the Hawaii Restaurant Association has been working on is getting with some of the healthcare providers and seeing how we can make this easier. And we do have a plan in place right now with HMAA. And if you contact HMAA, you can have their wellness department will help you to set up your employees and smooth the process and ease the process for you to get your employees vaccinated.
And that's great if you've got HMAA, right?
Well, not only for HMAA. They're also helping anybody out there. It's not only HMAA clients of theirs. So
they're willing to be the conduit regardless of what your insurer may be providing.
Exactly.
Because this is such an issue with people who work in food service at whatever level, and as you mentioned, that it's not easy to go off and just say, hello, doctor, I need to have a hepatitis A inoculation. Thank you very much. It's not that simple by any means. this still comes back down to what we teach people and how we watch each other. I will raise my hand and say that, yes, I've been in restrooms and I've watched people come out of them and literally walk right past the sink. Now, I think I may be turning into my grandmother because I will turn and say to them, aren't you going to wash your hands? Now, maybe that sounds horribly intrusive to some people, but when you're working in food service, is there a collaborative effort to help people to remember? Because you could have something on your mind and just, you know, blindly walk by. I'm not trying to impugn people's dignity, but to be able to say, this is an important thing. This is totally preventable. We don't have to have people sickened by something like this.
Right, and it is as easy as washing your hands. I mean, the vaccination is one thing, and that that's something that we're recommending that everybody get anyway. But it's you know, when you say an employee goes to the restroom and did you wash your hands, it's something very difficult to monitor. It does come down to continued training. It does come down to continued awareness of your staff and having meetings with your employees and saying, what would happen if the same thing that happened to Baskin-Robbins or Chili's happened to our restaurant? We may definitely going to have to cut back hours. We may have to cut back some of our staff because we're
sales
losing
have just
revenue.
Dropped.
Sales
yeah.
are going down, mm-hmm. and what are we going to do? We're not going to need as many people in the kitchen or on the floor. And you know, it's going to impact us all, not just the bottom line for the restaurant. Everybody's going to be impacted. So if you translate it in those terms to your staff that this impacts your bank account, this impacts your ability to pay your bills and your rent, you know, maybe they'll take it more into, you know, consideration more seriously.
Right, because sometimes you have to impact someone's wallet to be able to
exactly.
make a point. But there's also the issue of not just washing your hands and telling people to do that and reinforcing that message, but the way in which they wash their hands. Because mm-hmm. a lot of other studies are showing that although people may stop and wash, they're not washing long enough. And you know what we tell little kids about singing happy birthday twice and
sure.
washing your hands and all of that. You know, trying to make something light of it just to make sure that people actually do it and understand that if you have this kind of issue with your restaurant, as Baskin-Robbins will attest, and you watch your sales drop in high double digits, that may mean that somebody doesn't have a job anymore.
You're exactly right. And just because you run your hands underwater after you use the restroom doesn't mean you wash your hands. I think that soap is very important to that process. And there are actually special soaps that are out there that help to fight the bacteria and get the germs off your hands better. And we do see a lot of restaurants that are using that, especially at the hand sink in the kitchens. It does cost a little bit more than your average hand soap, so they may not use it in all the restrooms for everybody. But we do recommend that they use it in the hand sink in the kitchen. It does help to, you know, decrease the possibility of spreading germs.
All right. Well, we got to go, and we hope that when everybody else does too, they wash their hands.
True.
Thanks very much for coming in.
And thank you for having me.
Greg Fraser, the Executive Director for the Hawaii Restaurant Association.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Tory Richard Limited, celebrating 60 years of design for the island lifestyle. Tory Richard is proud to support local community news, public affairs, and talk programming on Hawaii Public Radio.
Helping people.
It made me feel good.
Taking care of people.
It's just something that
I wanted to help.
Hi, everyone. This is Bob Wehrman. It's time for The Benevolent Mind, our quest to discover the spark that ignites giving. Today's show is in the form of an extensive question about a man who gave much more than seems humanly possible. Ready? Who came from a long line of samurai, immigrated here from Japan in 1894, founded a major church in Honolulu, and was a pastor to two others, began a home for kids, and lodged his fellow countrymen in a dormitory he built? He put much effort into Americanizing Nisei in Hawaii, ministered to plantation workers in the fields who threw rocks at him, called him a traitor, then became beloved by them. He started the Japanese language school, helped found Midpack Institute, raised funds to build the new Anu YMCA, taught Japanese in public school, wrote many books, published 5 periodicals, began a Japanese language newspaper, had a famous lantern slide collection, and co-founded the AJA Baseball League, and as a descendant of samurai, was an expert in Japanese castles, which is one reason his church looks like part of the castle in Kochi, Japan. Who was this amazing man? One of Hawaii's most inspiring people, Reverend Tokie Okumura. Our program is a production of Hawaii Public Radio and is sponsored by the Hawaii Community Foundation, believing for 100 years that philanthropy is all about you. I'm Bob Wehrman.
And now we're going to get back to our backyard quiz. Earlier, we asked you if you knew the location of the statue of the famed sumo wrestler Akebono. Born in Windward, Oahu in May of 1969 as Chad Haaheo Rowan, Akebono became the first foreign-born sumo wrestler to reach Yokozuna, the highest sumo rank. Akebono retired from sumo after a 13-year career with a record of 566 wins, 198 losses, and 11 Emperor Cup titles. To commemorate the champion and beloved Hawaiian athlete, a statue of his likeness was commissioned and now stands in Akebono's hometown of Waimanalo. That's today's Backyard Quiz answer, and I think we had someone
Beth
who
and
called
Dave
in.
Dave from Honolulu, in fact, knew that, so he's going to be getting a T-shirt. And at 8:48, that's today's quiz. If you've got a quiz for us, you can send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from the College of Business at Hawaii Pacific University, whose MBA Flex Plus program offers a blend of classroom and online classes to fit the lives of working professionals. hpu.edu/business.
Saturday is the anniversary of a day that changed forever our understanding of the destructive nature of warfare, ushering in the age of anxiety when mankind came face to face with its capacity to destroy itself. An estimated 70 to 80,000 people were killed on August 6, 1945, when the first of 2 atomic bombs were dropped on Hiroshima, Japan. In an increasingly tense world, the nuclear threat is never far away, and Shom Evans Pym, director of the Center for Global Non-Killing, will speak on preventing nuclear war from a non-killing perspective at the Lahaina Jodo Mission on Sunday. He's on the line with us now. Good morning.
Good morning.
We've obviously lived with the nuclear threat ever since then. That's when it was brought home to the world, just exactly how destructive this was, and we've only learned more about the destructive capacity of nuclear weapons since. We also live in a world that is just filled with them, don't we?
We do. And, of course, much of the killing that happens all around the world is not directly linked with that weapon. But I think there's an underlying commonality on the legitimacy that our societies, our governments, our culture gives to killing, to lethality, and all the systems, including defense, which is built around that.
As you say, our culture has made the killing of other human beings legitimate, and all cultures do, don't they, to one degree or another?
Well, I mean, some anthropologists would probably argue on that, on if killing is really part of human nature, or rather, as the World Health Organization, for example, has claimed, is rather a preventable disease. And probably one of the interesting things, when we look at nuclear weapons from a non-killing perspective, is also the creative element of a project like the Manhattan Project, and the amount of resources that went into creating something that had been inconceivable at the time. And I think one of the reflections that we need to make at this stage is the need, the urgent need, to consider a similar project to overcome lethality, which is one of the major issues, which is affecting all spheres of life in our global society.
Shom, wasn't some of the, at least a lot of the research that led to the development of the nuclear bomb research that was simply looking for a new form of energy that could have been used for good or ill?
Indeed, and in fact, some of the scientists from physics, mathematics, and other fields that were engaged with the Manhattan Project actually withdraw their support during or just after the result. We take nuclear weapons for granted now, but again, at that stage in the 40s, when the Los Alamos laboratory was initiated, it was unimaginable. And I think it's that kind of mobilization of human resources, creativity, talent from all fields, which we now need to refocus from our conventional, cultural bias towards this legitimacy of violence toward finding alternatives. And it's no minor quest, and it's something that several organizations throughout the world are working on, and here in the Center for Global Nonkilling in Hawaii, we're also trying to contribute to that.
Well, Shom, when did Einstein write his letter about what was being unleashed with nuclear energy? I'm trying to recall. Didn't he write a letter to Roosevelt about this very thing?
Well, Einstein has several writings on the issue. The one of the most famous is probably the Einstein-Russell Manifesto, where, together with, and it's also related to the Pugwash Science and Peace Conferences that really challenged the destructive power that had been unleashed, and try to establish limitations to that use. And unfortunately, those calls were not listened to at the time, and the development that, and proliferation that came in the decades that followed, including the diversion of such huge amount of resources from life-enhancing policies to the development of this kind of weapons, not only in the U.S. but also in other powers at the moment, really have an impact on so much time and still today.
But the point of those messages was, as I understand it, that it's energy. It's using it for destructive purposes is a choice. That is not, as you say, is a preventable choice.
Mm-hmm. And indeed, I think this is not to question peaceful uses of science. And indeed, if we look back at the same period, and there's so many applications that the nuclear physics has in life enhancing aspects of life, such as medicine and other fields, it's really important. And we could also think of what kind of differences would we have been if the focus on the use of such technologies had been placed mostly on life enhancing aspects, such as in health, and especially in cancer and certain diseases that were in its infancy at the time the Manhattan Project started. And if we compare, they're still in many aspects, sadly, still in its infancy. And one of the measures for that is, for example, the amount of resources globally that are put into military spending, which is in global terms five times more than is applied to health research, for example. So I think a lot of change still has to happen in that field.
No one would disagree with that, Shom. Thanks very much for talking with us this morning.
Our pleasure.
Shom Evans-Pym is the director of the Center for Global Non-Killing. He will speak at the Lahaina Jodo Mission on Sunday at 5 p.m. on preventing nuclear war from a non-killing perspective. It's sponsored by the Hiroshima Nagasaki Commemoration Committee and Maui Peace Action. Thank you. One of the things that struck me about the discussion of hepatitis A was the wide variation in the cost of vaccines depending on which pharmacy you talk to.
Which pharmacy, and also having to go to, go through your doctor.
Yeah.
Greg Fraser said, it's not a matter of simply walking in saying, hey, I need a shot, kind of like the way we do with flu shots, for example.
And but it's clear that there was no mechanism in place for dealing with it.
Yeah, and that's part of it, that because this hasn't been an issue for quite a while and suddenly here it is again, that looking at what kind of mechanism can be put in place so that, people who work in food service want to have the vaccine can have it done all at once, and an employer or a manager can know that, hey, not on our watch.
Yeah. Of course, the whole essence of emergency planning is having mechanisms in place long before you need them.
Exactly. But we forget that a lot of the time.
Seems that way.
That's going to do it for this Thursday morning, but we'll be back with you for an Aloha Friday. We're going to sit down with Jan Ten Brinkenkate to talk about Hawaii's primary elections.
And an early Shakespeare comedy is in a historic setting.
You can call our talkback line anytime you like to leave us your comments. Here's the number. It's 808-792-8217. Or if you like email, we've got that too at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. You can post comments on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation. That's our page. Or tweet us at HI Conversation or tweet me at BKOZHPR.
And we archive all our past shows. You can find them on the Conversation page, along with links to information about guests and topics. That's under Talk Shows for the Conversation on HawaiiPublicRadio.org. I'm Chris Vandercook.
I'm Beth Ann Koslovich. We'll see you in the morning with more of The Conversation.